Return to Northmoor. Meta episode 4.
Hi folks, this is Tim. Welcome to Return to Northmoor Meta episode 4. I had the extreme pleasure to sit down with my urbane and ever appreciative group of players to look back over the last two seasons of Return to Northmoor and do a little recap of what's happened, a little shameless reminiscing, if you will. Unfortunately, Dan was not able to join us for this episode. You will hear Wick, Jeff, and Kim. Unfortunately, Kim never really gets a chance to introduce herself, but here you go. Oh, and this is an explicit episode. I did my best to beep things, but beeping can only do so much. Enjoy.
We have returned to Northmoor for a meta episode. My name is Wick. I am a Taurus. I like long walks on the beach, a little reading by candlelight. I also enjoy a good back rub. You know the kind I'm talking about, the kind that leads to sex. I also play in the game. My character is Rogan, who is a lot more sane, well, a lot more simplistic than I am. He's a fighter, because, you know, you have to have one. As have been coined many times throughout this podcast, I possess a rather unique set of dice in that they are large, weighty, and are excellent at keeping my dungeon master in order. However, they roll for shit.
Superb at rolling under 5.
I'm absolutely convinced my 20-sided die has no double digits on any of its sides.
Hello, I'm Jeff, and I play Seth in our game.
Very good.
Which one do I play?
I sound much cooler on a podcast than I do in person.
Yes, please edit this for intelligence. Should there be any?
Oh, Lord.
The podcast has put forth this illusion that I'm an excellent role player.
Right. So anyway, long, long time ago, I don't know how many years ago it was, I had it in my head that I would get together a group of players, I would go buy a quote-unquote canned module, and we would sit down and run it from beginning to end. And this was when D&D was, I think, just into 3.5. I'd gone down and, you know, to the local hobby store, picked up a handful of modules, and we began.
Some winners, too, man.
They were winners.
They started off pretty decent. And
there were a couple of good ones.
And then we got into a point where we just hit one or two that, and that's all it takes, really, is just one or two just absolute crap modules to just drag everything down.
Ooh, a stinker. Let's do something else.
Well, the problem is sometimes, even though you're reading through a given module, like the POS, for example, you're reading it from the perspective of, oh, okay, this individual room is kind of cool, or this individual encounter is kind of cool. And you don't oftentimes put it in perspective of, well, will they be jumping from here to here to here to here? And gosh, that would kind of suck. So anyway, this was, I don't know how many years ago that we started. The group has since morphed and changed, and we've gone through, I don't know how many different games at this point, but now we're to 5 players.
4 players, one GM.
One GM, 5 participants. When did we start? Anybody know?
I'm thinking right now.
We started gaming that system about 6 years ago.
So, to those listeners out there, 6 years, I think we've, what, capped out at level 8? So, you know how it goes. Can I go by an alternate name? Like, Viking? How about just DJ Wicked?
Wick the Dick.
Sure. That name only stands up from time to time.
Oh, God! So, you know, you need to talk about the POS, though, guys.
Oh, yeah. That's Jeff.
The POS, Dark Mantles.
It had grand, grand ideas. And it had some things in it that were really tantalizing, that looked good on paper.
Well, I'm sure it was same sort of thing. You read it.
Yeah, because you read it in little pieces without realizing how large it is. I mean, it says right on the cover, largest. There's just a lot of monotony and stupid crap that you could edit it down to a decent module that would fit in 15 pages instead of the physics book that it was.
Well, let's be fair. As I understand it, as that thing was written, it was written by a culmination of people.
Yeah, no one person wrote the whole thing.
Right, so whoever wrote the beginning of that thing,
it seemed like that was the last thing they did. In my opinion, they started at the end and worked back. Well, we're getting down to the lower parts now.
That's true.
I mean,
and
it was horrible.
Very painful for me because the lower levels are my favorites to play and run. So in the module's defense, there are people that have played it and enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And there are just as many other people who have played it and not enjoyed it.
They're from other countries, as far as I know. Last I checked.
Now that
they
was offensive.
They were from over the ocean.
Sure, they read Dark Mantle and thought it said
Fiendish Dark Mantle.
So how many characters did each of us go through During the time.
No, it just got to the point where we were sick and freaking tired of
Dark
Mantle.
We were like, this is dumb.
Fiendish
Dark Mantle.
Yeah, it absolutely sucked.
Yeah.
And I think what it was is that...
It had no low-level
challenges. It was written in such a form that you literally walk into rooms where your light sources don't work, you can't see, there's nothing you can do, Dark Mantles jump on your face, and you're essentially, for all intents and purposes,
yeah, exactly. Here's another challenging room.
And room after room after room of that, it just got old.
Yeah, there was no situation for the players to have any real input at all.
Not only that, but we all had our player hats on of, okay, we're going to go into this dungeon with, quite honestly, no real purpose, other than this is the world's freaking largest dungeon.
Yeah.
And we want to see it from beginning to end. So you go in and you do that. You're hearing that, oh my gosh, it's written by all these different people. It covers level 1 through 30. It's got all this stuff in really cool rooms.
I don't even think it was 30. It was like 20.
20.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, whatever, you know.
Not like we ever got close to
yeah, exactly.
That.
Yeah, exactly.
Might as well be 1 through 6, man.
It doesn't change the fact that from a day-to-day perspective, I mean, literally all of us are taking times out of our lives, so to speak, to get together, to have some fun, to socialize, and ultimately to do a little bit of gaming. But the problem is when the gaming is the same crap over and over and over again through your first, I don't know what it was. I mean, realistically, we probably got through what, like 40 rooms or so?
How many sessions did we play, do you think?
Four?
Four or five, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was just crap. It was just the same stuff.
Well,
over
do you
over.
Think that part of the problem was that it was a technical exercise rather than a role-playing exercise? Where the only things that characters could say was, this sucks ass?
I don't think that kind of game can be a role-playing game. I mean, fully and extensively. It's not the kind of thing where you write elaborate characters with detailed histories. You just simply have the idea of, oh, wow, look,
let's
bought this brick of a module here. Why don't you throw some characters together and away we go?
So do you think that all of us walked into it with the wrong impression?
No.
Because we all had high hopes, but I don't think any of us... At least speaking for myself, I had no illusions that it was going to be a campaign world in a dungeon. Or I never thought it would be a large role-playing exercise. I mean, there was certainly opportunity. And yeah, with our group, we can
bullshit our
we can make a
anything.
Lot of role-playing opportunity out of not very
I think,
much.
I think, to be fair, when we originally started with the quote-unquote old-school mentality of sitting down and playing modules, we were playing different modules that had, in some cases, some very cool backstories and tie-ins
Absolutely.
To what we were doing. Once we got through that to a point where... You know, the crowd kind of got thinned in real life, affected some of us, and we lost some players and so forth. We decided we'd start over. And the idea of the world's largest dungeon, if I'm not mistaken, was this is a little more beer and pretzels. This is something where we don't have to commit a lot of creativity.
Right.
This is
right.
something where literally we can come from the busy days of our lives and get together and roll some dice and have
Another
fun.
Strange thing that came about for me while playing in this group is that my life outside the game changed a lot. You know, kids and wives and stuff like that.
Just
and,
one wife.
And yeah, just the one.
It's okay, dude. She's not listening.
Nor will she ever. She thinks we're nerds.
And she's
But we
right.
became very greedy for our gaming opportunities to be high quality because I had a very small window of opportunity to play, and I wanted it to be enjoyable and top-notch quality. I had no tolerance for the nonsense of the Dark Mantle.
Fiendish Dark Mantle.
Yeah, fucking Dark Mantle.
Fucking fiendish Dark Mantles.
Yeah. Anyway, so I think what we thought we wanted, which was casual gameplay, sort of beer and pretzels, sitting around rolling dice, and that was it, two things happened. I think we realized, one, the role-playing aspect, the character development, the plot elevation, the world building, all that sort of stuff was important to us. And as much as we wanted or thought we wanted to get away from it, the more of it we avoided, the more we realized how much we wanted it. And that coupled with the fact that the rooms were repetitious, they were annoying, they didn't give you any tie-ins as to why the hell your character, even though he was nothing but numbers on a piece of paper, would want to be there, it just got really tough to stomach. And ultimately, when you're giving up however many hours per week to do this sort of stuff, you got to get some sort of return on your investment. And I think it's...
Which was substantial, I recall. Wasn't it $100?
Yeah. I think it's important to realize as gamers, or at least for us, that we value the time that we put towards gaming. It's not just because I am a gamer, I don't care what I do so long as I'm gaming. It's what am I doing while I'm gaming? What are the people around me doing? How much fun are we having? How much fun is the person running it having? How much story, character development, all that sort of stuff.
And beyond even our foray into the world's largest dungeon, our player group got to the point where we had to make changes at one point as well.
Yeah.
And do you think that our player group changed because of the focus of the majority? That most of us prefer to have character-driven, intelligent storylines, world-building plots?
Well, yeah, I mean...
And there were people that were interested just in, I want to kill things, I want to roll dice, I want to drink beer, I want to have pretzels.
When we started off, we had many more players than we do now.
Absolutely.
And in some cases, kind of different players. Even though Dan was with us at the very beginning, he had to drop out. He was doing the whole
school thing.
We had some people that showed up for the first game, and we never saw them again.
Other people that joined in later and so forth.
And they come in, they leave. And right.
And I think that what happens is that on one hand, the person running the game, whoever it might have been at whichever given time, wants some level of commitment. Now, you know, we all have real lives and shit. We're all... old, well, not, I wouldn't say old farts, but some
we're
of us
old
are getting
farts
there.
For gamers, we're pretty old farts.
We're old farts.
You take a look at your group, and anytime you try to make a story cool, anytime you try to get a specific character or group of characters involved in something or motivated by something, when one or more of them disappears on a game night, it's tough. You know, if suddenly you've got a specific element of a story that is catered to one specific character, like tonight is your night, Bob. You know, we're going to explore the dark secrets of your past, and suddenly Bob can't make it. It's just a big, you know, shit in the mouth at that point. We have lost people in this group, some because of attrition, because of real life, or because of a lack of an ability to commit to the group, or because they got through one portion of this group's long frickin' life and just decided, you know what, I'm done. Or we had decided as a quote-unquote majority on a specific person or person's absence that, you know what, their play style and our play style doesn't really mesh. And that happens. You know, it's just...
Certainly not.
You end up with situations where you've got people that might be cool people, might be good friends, but ultimately certain players in your group are starting to click and you're starting to get a feel for the world and the game and what to expect and what you want and what commitments people are making.
And then all of a sudden... if I come back to your game, I'm going to get fucking divorced. Do you understand? I do not want that. Is there anybody we've played with that you don't like? Hell no, of course not. We like everybody we've played with. They're not all here anymore.
Yeah, obviously that would... you know, but there are times when I've been in groups where somebody says, oh, hey, I know a guy who plays D&D who would love to play our game. Okay, cool. Bring him along. You know, you kind of trust the person... that they have an idea of who this person is as a gamer, but they might know that person forward and backwards as a person, but have no idea what they're like as a gamer.
And as a gamer, they can be totally different than what
absolutely
they are in real life.
They want
to
escape from their real life and do it by being a pedophile or who knows what they want to play at that point.
Easy.
It doesn't change the fact that the guy or girl has to tell that person, you're a nice person and all, but you fucking suck in my game.
You just and
have
square
you ever,
peg round hole, sorry.
Have you ever been in a game where they say, look, we're going to give you a 5-session...
No.
A trial period? You've never been in one of those games?
I've never been on gaming probation.
I have never been.
Knowingly.
I've never been on parole or probation or any sort of examination period.
Wow.
You, know, you got paroled from this game.
Sit down for your interview from our players.
You know I actually started a game where they said, okay, well, we know you and we know what your game style is, but we'll see how you work out within the game. Huh? And we'll give you 5 tries.
How old were you when that happened?
It was recent.
Yeah. So you were older. They were older. They understood...
time.
What disaster it can be to have some retard enter the
absolutely
game.
Absolutely.
I love retards, by the way.
Go-tards.
Go-tards.
All the special people out there. If you're wearing a helmet, I love you. But that's something that you've learned later in life. Most of us started when we were in college. Well, not started, but ended up running into people that we normally otherwise didn't game with while we were in college because, you know, you're all on your own and you have to find a new group of friends and so forth. So that's really when the trial period starts out. And you kind of identify where people's strengths are as players, where people's strengths are as people running the game. I know people that run excellent games play for crap and people that play excellent games and run for crap. And those are the sorts of things you figure out.
So early on in your gaming career, do you think that you kind of figured out the style of gameplay that you prefer? That you go, no. Oh, well, you know, I really like the beer and pretzels. I'd rather just hang out with my friend.
To be honest, the earlier in my life you take a look at, the more gaming I was doing and the more I was getting a little bit of everything from all different angles, so to speak. I think as you get older, obviously time becomes a premium. Your question is, as much as I love gaming, what am I getting out of it as far as just socialization, the people that I'm hanging out with, what kind of game is it, what game are we playing, that sort of stuff. I mean, people have a favorite genre or style or mechanic game, but I think as I get older, I don't have any one need. I love a beer and pretzels game. I love a game at a con that's a 4-hour one shot with a group of people I've never met in my life. I love sitting down with a group of people such as this that I know and have games with for a long time, to where you have a really, really intense game where you've got a lot of role playing, got a lot of character development or secrets revealed or whatnot, where you're spending more time in character than out of character. And I also love the nights where you literally sit down and all you're doing is rolling dice from beginning to end. You're tweaking the system and trying to min-max and all that sort of stuff.
I think that's what it's about, is that flexibility, because there's not everyone has the flexibility to enjoy all those different situations. And that's what makes you have to get rid of a player. Is when they become a one-note song, it's like, okay, we've heard your song, and we're on to the next thing.
Because I think with this group, we're very dynamic. I mean, there are some nights where it's like, we're going to sit down, and we're going to do battle after battle after battle. And then there's other nights where Wick and I'll sit at the table, and we'll have a role-playing session, and Dan and Jeff will go into the kitchen, and they'll have a role-playing session, and that's how our nights go.
They call that drinking.
Well, I wasn't going to go there, but you could say that.
We were role-playing.
You were at the inn.
But not everybody can handle that style of game. They want to know what's going to happen every night.
Quite honestly, there's a feeling out period for any game session at any point, no matter how well you know somebody. I think that if we take a look at this group, and we've taken hiatuses in the past with other game systems, other genres and worlds and whatnot, some of which have been successful, some of which have not been. But I think that's also part of that feeling out period, you know, where somebody sits down and they have picked up a game that they think looks cool. Whether it's something off the shelf or something they found online, whatnot, they look at it. That individual looks at it and thinks, wow, that's really cool. I love the world, the setting. I love the mechanics. I love just the way that it's written, whatever. And they decide they want to share that with a group of friends. Now, somebody like us, who is a pretty tight-knit group of people who are very understanding, willing to put on the, you know, I'll be good hat, so to speak, with any game. But ultimately, through the course of that game, we may quickly identify that for that particular game or genre or mechanic or whatnot, it doesn't jive with everybody. You know, we're not hitting on all cylinders. I think at this point, we have a really good sense as a group of how we are in the world of Dungeons and Dragons, a little less so when it comes to a lot of these other areas. And that's simply because as a group, we've played far more Dungeons and Dragons than we have anything else.
Don't you think that that's part of our summer hiatus that we usually take? We usually take some time off in the summer and go, okay, has somebody found a cool game they want to play?
I don't know that it's something that we make a conscious effort to do at some point, right?
The only time we ever really did a big system switch up is when we discovered that 4th edition was imminent. I mean, we had come up with a ridiculous amount of alternate rules for 3.5. We had reinvented the wheel, and then when we discovered that all of our work was soon to be out of date, we kind of became disenchanted with D&D for a minute.
Well, I think two things hit us. One is we had, to some degree, and this, whether or not this happens to all the groups or just us, we've played this group for a while, we've got a good sense of what the characters are, suddenly all of us are thinking of prospects of new characters and other ideas and so forth. I don't know if it was that, or if it was 4th edition, or whatever hit us at the time that we were playing the previous story, I will call it that, the previous D&D story that led us up to this, where, you know, we just decided we'd hit the reset button. And it wasn't the first time that we've done that. We've done that several times. I don't know how many, quite honestly, in these past...
Many years.
Years.
Many years.
That we've done it, but...
3 times or 4 times with the original group. And then since then, so we got to be getting close to 10 restarts.
Yeah, and I'd be curious, quite honestly, how many people out there... Because I, for one, am the kind of person that when I write a character, I have one idea in my head. When I play a character, it inevitably becomes something else. It's just circumstance and how many situations you're presented with to where you are A, forced to present things that you hadn't thought of, or B, forced to present things you had thought of but not necessarily in the light in which you'd hoped to have presented it. So once you've gotten enough of the character that's in your head out, or have developed enough of the character that's on paper to where you are strong with that character, as soon as I hit that comfort level of, okay, I now know this character, my brain starts to wander into other character possibilities. Whether it's a class, a race, or a concept. And concept is usually the big one for me, where I suddenly have another idea, maybe inspired by the very game that I'm playing in, where we've run into an NPC or I've envisioned a city as such and people that as such that might be within it. And then suddenly my brain starts to get along that path. And consciously or subconsciously, I get to a point in a game where we might be far enough along to where suddenly my new idea is sparking a lot more energy out of me than the character that I'm playing.
So, and I think that in Return to Northmoor, we have that opportunity. We certainly have seen Dan switch out characters.
Yeah.
You know, we took a small hiatus and he was like, you know, I think that this is a great character, but I want to try something new. And so there's that kind of flexibility.
He did that to cover up missing teeth in the smile.
Well, yeah, we did need some firepower. But now he's talking about switching back to Oshkind playing the thief.
Well, to be fair to him, he made a switch because he had felt or thought that there was obviously that gap within the party. And then I ended up returning and that gap to effect, you know, my dice actually started to roll well. So that gap got filled.
I was going to say, it wasn't just the fact that you were gone.
You know, but I think that when you're playing a system from 1 to 30, you do have the opportunity to kind of think that, well, maybe I want to try something new. Yeah. And especially with more and more books coming out, more and more classes, more and more races becoming available, that you want to try something new.
Which is why, even though I buy them, I don't read them.
You don't read them.
No, I've decided at this point that all I'm going to read is fighter stuff.
Until he dies.
Which can't happen in 4.0.
That's why you always need threat of death in a game so you can have something new.
So did you buy the PH2?
Yeah, and I bought the martial power. I bought the arcane power. I will buy the other books as they come rolling out. But I haven't read them. And that's simply because I am hoping that by not... And see, none of us, when we started with 4.0, obviously, knew anything about it. When I created my character, I only read the fighter stuff, the fighter powers, capabilities, so forth. I ended up with the fighter decision simply because I thought the fighter is the most classic of all the classes. If I was to wear a badge on my shirt, so to speak, of I took this character to level 30, I didn't want to coin Jeff's phrase, have some half carrot that I ended up taking to level...
Half carrot fembot
to level 30. I wanted something to when people looked at the nerdy badge on my shoulder and said, wow, human fighter level 30? Why the hell did you do that? The fighter is, to me, the quintessential, the basis of all of Dungeons and Dragons. I mean, it is the kind of thing that if you were soloing in a game, you are a fighter. You're not the wizard running around, you know, for God's sake, especially in anything prior to 4.0 because you're dead. But the idea of, I wanted to cling to something classic. I thought that it had merit. And I think in 4.0, more so than any other fighter mechanic, shall I say, is that you actually have some options at that point. You got some things that you can choose between from encounter to encounter. In fact, from swing to swing. Whereas before it was grab 20, roll damage, rinse and repeat over and over for every single encounter you were in. There was no, the only thing that separated a fighter from a fighter was my fighter uses a two-handed sword. My fighter uses a polearm. My fighter uses a bow. You know, and that was it. It was just what goofy thing is sitting in my backpack that defines me as a character. And that was kind of crap. So with 4.0, looking at the powers, I thought maybe this finally was the addition of Dungeons and Dragons that would allow the fighter to not only to be good and serve purpose within the party, but be enjoyable to the player.
Not boring.
Yeah.
Do you think that 4E has succeeded in that?
In the case of the fighter, and again, that's all I have read, I think, absolutely. I think that I do have some thoughts about areas of the fighter that I think are, I don't know why they pigeonholed him to a certain degree in the, you have a two-handed weapon or you have a shield and weapon. The whole idea of a fighter with a bow, even to some extent, the fighter with a pole arm is not very well represented in the game.
Or the guy with the net and the ransuer. It's all gone.
The net and the trident.
It's all gone.
Yeah, I think that some of that isn't played out very well. So to a degree, you have more to do with your fighter, but you're also a little more of a niche at this point, you know. But I do think that they've done a really good job with that. And I think that you literally could have two or three fighters in a party that could be very different from one another. And especially with the expansion of the martial power book, there are enough things that somebody can do, especially with the myriad of different racial capabilities and whatnot, that you could literally have a group of three fighters in your party that could be very distinct individuals to some degree, as far as capability. So have you read Beyond the Cleric?
Very little. Just brief passages referenced to me by others.
Yeah, I think for me, what 4th edition did was somebody or somebody's sat down in a room and thought, what is it that makes D&D D&D? And that was combat. since the beginning, it's been you don't get jack crap in this game if you don't fight monsters. And so somebody in realizing that said, well, let's take that and let's build upon it. Let's take every single class and make them worthwhile in combat. Let's separate them by capability while within the realm, the experience, the encounter of combat. And I think that that's what finally, in my opinion, kind of balanced a lot of these classes in Dungeons & Dragons. Now, you know, the thief, who used to be the king of non-combat stuff they could do, climbing walls and hiding in shadows and countless other percentage rolls that you were making. But once you got into combat, if the thief didn't have his surprise attack...
You screwed.
Yeah, it was just kind of like, well, what does he do? Well, he sits in the back with the wizard.
He loots the dead bodies. Yeah. That's what he does.
Yeah. Or he tries desperately to sneak around to untie the princess who's on the altar while everyone else fights the bad guy.
He pries the eyes out of the idol.
Seriously, if you want a diehard role-playing game and you're thinking you're getting that out of D&D, you need to get out more.
It's not that you can't.
No.
D&D has always been an excellent framework to build role-playing onto.
You can sit down and play a game of Clue and role-play the out of that game, but it doesn't change the
fact. We've never done that. Let the record show.
It doesn't change the fact that certain games lend themselves to role-playing more so than others. And D&D, I don't believe, has ever been a game that's emphasis has been role-playing so much as it has been combat. D&D does it very, very well. I mean, I don't know how many times as a kid growing up to where you're playing some other game. You might be playing a Space Master game. You might be playing a Top Secret game. You might be playing a Car Wars game. And you're sitting there, you're like, how long can I hold my breath? And you're like, I have no freaking idea. So you grab the D&D book, read the Dungeoneering Survival Guide or whatever the heck it was, and find out, oh my gosh, this is what the average human hold breath thing is, and this is what it'd be modified by, and then you change
it. Made it into Top Secret eventually. in the companion book.
Sure, but you understand what I'm saying is that the mechanics of stuff during the course of conflict were prevalent throughout the rules of Dungeons & Dragons, and I think that D&D has always done combat well, and that has been a lot of its focus. I mean, that's how you get experience points. How you get treasures, how you get character advancement, all that sort of stuff. And I think come fourth edition, they finally realized that, you know what, we've had characters that very much excel in the course of combat, who are very productive in the course of combat, and we have some classes that are not, such as the low-level magic use, you know, the thief once he's out of cover in darkness, you know, that sort of stuff. And they decided, you know what, well, let's, and it's my humble opinion, this is just me, that they've taken a big lesson from a lot of the online MMOs that are really all about combat as well, and online game balance has become a huge issue, and games are constantly be tweaking back and forth, whether they're nerfing somebody or adding new capabilities. And I think that D&D kind of realized that potential, that by quite literally balancing all of their classes and or races in the course of combat, everything else would be cool by that point.
Because everything else was already pretty much balanced.
Yeah, absolutely.
I agree that the main framework of Dungeons & Dragons has been combat. That does not say that you can't role play within the system.
No, it's a great framework to do that within, but if you want to advance through the game system, you must have combat.
Again, you can role play a game of Clue. My point is, if you've got a good group of people, it doesn't matter what game is in front of them, they can role play out of that thing. What I will say is that D&D over the course of time, with their tie-in to miniatures, has tried desperately to get the game to the tabletop, get it to the mat, get it with miniatures in people's hands, so that ultimately, I don't know if it's you know, WotC's desire to just sell more miniatures or have multiple games or whatnot, but it doesn't change the fact that, yes, I don't disagree with the statement that the tactical aspect of the game, the role-playing light aspect of D&D, has become more and more prevalent from 3rd to 3.5 to 4, where there used to be a time where we used to game on couches, you know, with maybe a coffee table to just toss dice onto. But people would roll on the back of books or on a clipboard or something like that. Now, literally, if you don't have that tactical map, somebody, say the fighter, for example, or somebody who's got a lot of movement related skills, light, like the thief, the warlord, suddenly, if you don't have that mat there, if you don't have that miniature representation of the world around you, you suddenly are emasculated, if you will, in your capabilities with that character, because you don't have the sense of, well, if I could just pull off this super move where I can move 3 squares and anybody in that square I get a free attack on, etc., etc.
Didn't we recently attempt a relatively detailed combat without a mat just out of laziness, and we instantly were like, how did we do this before? And a lot of it is certainly the rules, but how did we always have to have arguments about, no, you can't see him from here, and how did we get through all that?
I think the answer is this: with a good group of people that are accepting, understanding, understanding and trustworthy. You can do anything. So I think you could honestly have a group of people who could sit down and take the world of Dungeons and sit down and play it strictly in the theater of the mind without having to go to mats and miniatures and so forth. But I think that a lot of the recent writings in the Dungeons & Dragons rules have lent themselves to X number of squares, X number of movement, X number of burst, whatnot. And you literally kind of diminish capabilities of a given character and or party by escaping from that. Unless in the theater of the mind, the person who's running that game has the capability to say, you know what you're doing is cool. It affects this. Yeah.
We talked a little bit earlier before we started recording about how games have moved toward everybody gets to be the DM a little bit. And in combat, that's how D&D does it. D&D lets players be the DM by letting the players see where everyone is on the mat, and they can count squares, and they can figure all that out for themselves. They don't rely on the DM to tell them what they can and can't do.
Yeah, I think what it has done, and maybe this lends itself back to what Kim was saying, and that is the tactical aspect of D&D. By laying all that stuff down, putting that power in the player's hands, D&D tries or does become more of a tactical game in that instance. And that's simply because you've got enough information as a player to make educated decisions based on the capabilities of your character or your group to do certain things on that mat with your miniature and with your die rolls to execute moves, maneuvers, and powers that, quite honestly, take advantage of the environment in which you're in.
Without waiting for your DM to tell you, yeah, you can do that.
Right. To be quite honest, if you didn't have the mat, if you didn't have the powers defined as they are, and you were just playing within the theater of the mind, I think you likely could miss other opportunities that would only occur if you saw things out on a table.
Well, that's certainly the case. I see that every combat we have.
It's easy to have the theater of the mind when you've got the players versus one bad guy, but you turn the players against a group of 20 or 30.
And put complex terrain like pits and fires and...
Suddenly, it's really, really difficult to execute a lot of that with any degree of accuracy to where your players are comfortable making use of specific abilities that are related to space or environment.
All right, folks, at that point we went ahead and took a break and reorganized ourselves to try to decide what we want to talk about next, and we'll come back with the second half of our discussion, which will be more of a recap of the campaign in our next meta episode. Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you next time. You've been listening to Return to Northmoor, a podcast released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 2.5 license by Tim White and Kim Stone. Our theme music is Charge of the Valiant from Dronolin's Tower, Legends of Kithelin Volume 1, Tales of the Long Forgotten, used by permission of its composer, David Alan Young. Find out more about their fantastic gaming music at dronolin.com. Visit us and many other fine podcasts at spookyouthouse.com.